The idea is that for every, for the one term in the one ontology, you can define it using a set of sentences in the other ontology. And I mean, this has been done for example, my favorite example is in geometry. Hilbert's theory of geometry, axioms for geometry from 1900, had three primitives: points, lines, and planes, and various relations. 50 years later, Tarski had his axioms for geometry, in which he had only one primitive: points, and a corresponding set of relations. And so, even though these two ontologies look very different in terms of their primitives, you can prove that they are actually equivalent. That the terms of one ontology can be defined using the terms of the other, and vice versa. So there's a sense in which these are kind of equivalent ontologies. And so given that we have this kind of a very rigorous definition of a relationship between ontologies, we can then ask this well-posed logical problem, given two theories, determine whether there exists a non-trivial theory that generalizes both. Again, it may turn out that they are equivalent, or it could turn out that there is this other theory that generalizes both, so these two theories we're talking about are extensions of this more generic, more upper-level kind of ontology. And so this allows us to not only describe relationships between upper-level ontologies, but also in some way to say, well, what do you mean by upper-level ontology? What do you mean by an intermediate-level ontology? Okay, an intermediate-level ontology will be one that has generalizations in this kind of library of ontologies. The higher you go, the more general the ontology, the more upper level it is. When you get theories that have no generalizations, then those would be considered to be upper level ontologies. Next slide. Now the thing is that there are some requirements. So okay, we have this well-posed logical problem. It has a definite answer, yes or no. There either exists a generalization of two ontologies or they does not exist. But in order to actually prove that one ontology is the generalization of another, we do need to have something to work with. We need to be able to say that this ontology has a consistent set of axioms. There has to be a set of axioms, this can't just be terms, and you want some guarantee that this set of axioms is actually consistent. The other point is that this ontology needs to really axiomatize its intended law, the intended meanings of these terms. Okay, if you have an insufficient set of axioms, I think this is one of the sources of difficulty in Adam's example, the process example. Why it's hard is if you have one ontology that has only one or two axioms for each term, then it will always be the case that there will be some models of those axioms, probably always be the case, that there will be some models of those axioms, or some intended models that you have in your head about what a process means, what component means, which are not going to be models of the axioms. Or they'll be unintended models. They'll be models of the axioms that don't actually correspond to what your intuition is. But if they're not in the axioms, then comparing these things is incredibly difficult. And I think that's what Adam kind of identified. But I think the problem is not in the mapping or the definition of what a mapping is, but in the actual ontologies themselves. There needs to be some more meat on the bones, so to speak. And there's a free word I learned the other day, Lego mapping. Battle over words. That's what a lot of these meetings end up being. A lot of the sessions end up being battles over words. And I'm hoping we can replace these battles over words with discussions about axioms. Lest people say, as people have said in the past, and most people in the past have said this, whatever, where are you going to get ontologies that look like this? Well, with TSL, we've done this kind of work. It's a modular ontology. And it is an upper-level ontology in terms of process, so you have less scope than many of the other ontologies we've talked about today. It's not like the universe and everything, it's just a little piece of it. And within PSL, there are two kinds of theories. There are core theories that actually ties kind of the primitive concepts and definitional extensions. I'll just say a few words about that. But in terms of the core theories, there's a very rigorous method methodology that we follow and we've proven for each of the theories, component theories within the ontology. First, we specify the class, some class of structures, which is intended to capture the intended meanings of the terms. We prove an existence theorem that shows this class of structures actually exists, it's not empty. Mathematical structures. We characterize these structures up to what's known as isomorphism. So in other words, we kind of provide some way of characterizing these structures. But if you saw one on the street, you'd recognize what it is. Okay, so mathematicians will say, well, I have the single group theory, and I'll come up with some axioms for what groups are. But that's not really, doesn't give you insight into what these things are. So they actually provide classification theorems and say, well, here is a way of describing all possible groups, and here's some examples. You can build up all the others from the set of examples. Like I say, if someone in the street, you say, yep, that's a group. Then what we do is we prove a satisfiability theorem. We show that any mathematical structure in the class in step one actually satisfies the axioms of the ontology. So what this does is proves that the ontology is consistent. Or it's actually what's known as a relative consistency proof. And finally, we prove what's known as the axiom passability theorem. We show that any model of the axioms is equivalent to some structure in the class. So for each one of the theories in ontology, we go through this kind of procedure. And what that does is gives us enough substance that we can actually prove math terms. And in fact, this is where the kind of modularity, next slide, modularity in PSL comes up, is that each of the modules, each of the theories in this diagram, is the minimal set of axioms that's required to prove all those theorems I have in the previous slide. Okay, so in PSL core, there are just basic concepts of what are activities, negative occurrences, time points, and objects. There's a class of structures, and PSL core is the minimal set of axioms needed to prove that kind of theorem. And so each of the arrows in this diagram here refers to extensions. And for John Bateman, the dashed arrows refer to non-conservative extensions. So what that means is that in the extension, you can prove new theorems in the earlier language than you could not prove in the more restricted, the more general kind of theory. And I think that, again, this is another reason, perhaps, why Adam's example of process, the mapping of process is difficult, is if you have an ontology that's non-modular, then, like you said, it's like pulling a big bowl of spaghetti, and where did the end come? We should follow that methodology of finding the minimal set of axioms needed to prove particular kinds of consistency theorems. I think we can make some progress there. Next slide, the definitional extensions. The definitional extensions in ontology, we use that previous methodology, but what we also do is takes kind of another tip from the mathematicians by identifying invariants, so properties of the models that are preserved by isomorphism. Because one of the things that you want to say if you have a semantics preserving mapping is that you are preserving the models, and preserving models being associated with isomorphism. And so many of these invariants end up being related to group theory and semigroups and whatnot. But the whole ontology is designed in the sense that every definitional extension corresponds to a unique invariant, and every class of elements in that extension correspond to different values for the invariant. So we'll go to the next step, next proof to actually show that it is an invariant and that you capture all the values of the invariants. So just in summary, again, I think we have an opportunity here to kind of refocus some work and take a rigorous approach to the shareability and reusability of upper-level ontologies. But this might require that we do some extensions to existing ontologies. If some of these upper-level ontologies don't have axioms, I think we need to initiate efforts to add axioms to them, or to complete the set of axioms if they have an incomplete set of axioms. It may require modification of existing ontologies. If there's an ontology that's not modular, maybe need to be some effort addressed to trying to modularize that ontology. otherwise this problem would be insurmountable. And then just, you know, finally my main slogan for today is that, you know, we want to be able to replace some of these interminable debates with well-posed logical problems. Problems that have an answer, yes or no.
Calculans.
Calculans.
So are you saying that philosophical and interminable are synonyms?
Depends. In WordNet, I think they are.
You see, it will become me, but the question is what it will be able to describe.
Right.
You see, because, I mean, the completeness is formally is one notion, and completeness relative to some needs, to some applications, a different notion. One, the second, contradiction is part of it. You know, you cannot really write a reasonable, practical system so that it really is sound.
Yeah, not
impossible.
Well, not every theory in a library of ontology needs to be mutually consistent with each other.
No, I think but you see, it's a lot of requirements. And also, have you estimated the complexity? What you have to pay in taxation in order to get to
my research.
We have 5 minutes to discuss, and then we, at 20 after, we really have to leave to go to the other building. We'll be back here at 1 o'clock. You'll be able to leave your computers here because it'll be locked. Okay, I have a question, Mike. So if some of these upper ontologies lack axioms, how do we determine which axioms they lack?
That's a good question. I think there's two sources for identifying what are the intended, you know, semantics for that. And because that's where you have to begin, is what are you intending? I mean, Nicola, Mike will probably talk about this in his talk too, in a similar methodology. You know, what are you trying to capture by a particular term? Which you can identify that, you know, and then formalize what the structures are. That's often the hard part. So one way of identifying what the intended semantics is would be is in terms of, well, from the designers. When you really try to extract from the designers of that ontology, what they meant. Another one is in terms of the applications. When one of the ways that you can say, well, given a piece of software, you know, what is the emphasis ontology and piece of software, if you can use the ontology as a way of predicting how a piece of software is going to behave, right? Given a set of inputs, you know, what is it going to, you know, give us an output? If you use the ontology as a way of predicting that, you can evaluate, well, you know, what are the strange answers that are coming up from the axioms, the incomplete set of axioms I have for my ontology, and use it as a way of identifying, well, it seems to be making some counterintuitive answers here, and that would be a source of identifying. It's trying to identify what are the unintended models, and then writing axioms to scare them away.
Anyway, in my afternoon presentation, I will focus on, I will try to answer this question, focusing on the need to establish a common strategy to elicit hidden assumptions. And I'll say something about that.
Okay, great.
I have a question for Doug.
Go ahead.
He said that there was no need for separate ontologies, but instead you're using context, but logically, context is much like a separate ontology. So what do you mean by it's not a separate ontology, but is a separate ontology?
You can view them as separate as you wish, but it's not like they have to exist as different systems. There's no reason why you can't, in some sense, have one single logical language which has a set of assertions, and as long as some of those assertions start with yes, it's okay if you then have contradictions among what is the different context parts.
Yes,
it's basically just a way of saying in some context or micro theory, some thing, some assertion, some axiom is true or holds or can be taken as true. And
well,
so
in some ontology.
Yeah, so you could say exactly. And so if you want, you can say in this other person's ontology, according to conversion, whatever is out there. But you can also basically import those things into the same system and have them all coexist together.
I think I agree with nearly everything everyone said, which is just encouraging, even though sometimes what people are saying might seem to contradict. Just to add something at this stage, I always find very interesting about people insisting on having axioms, because I spent most of my life trying to get people to take axioms or rules or constraints out of systems. This is what's been stopping people doing the things they need to do, the wrong axiom. And I've had much more experience of the wrong axiom getting in the way than of having a lot of time to get as many of the right axioms as possible. Not that I think that's a bad thing, by the way. There's a different emphasis that you can see. Is there anything that your work would do with regard to that? I'm thinking of motivation as well, by the way, as you were saying earlier. Could we do to help elicit wrong accents as well as which ones were really bad?
The kind of metal object is pretty much like a waterfall. It really is. There's so much feedback going on. Really, what happens in practice is people will write a few accents down corresponding to meaningful sentences that they would write down. Say, well, what do I mean by this term? And then to say, okay, well, what are the models of these actions that they look like? And you try to, identify, well, what are the ones that are strange? And then kind of tend to interpret. So sometimes it turns out that they actually were intended, you hadn't thought of
it. You cannot do it if you're trying to use them in a system, all right? Because you can talk about, you can think that your axioms are wonderful, right? But every system from every frequency of thing you have to go into the correction.
Let me just underscore that. There have been a few people who seem to be advocating, I'm not sure if this is what they're really advocating, seem to be advocating, don't realize just how bad it would be to advocate. The idea that you have human beings manually write down, let's say, English or Chinese or whatever, interpretations of what these predicate calculus axioms are meant to represent. If you do that, that way lies all sorts of error and heartache. What you need to do is develop a system, even if it's somewhat stilted, that automatically generates natural language from the formal representations. You can do that fairly simply. It won't generate wonderful natural language, but it will generate understandable natural language. And you will realize very often that the axiom you wrote wasn't really what you meant to write.
Okay, folks, we have to stop now. Those on the phone will continue at 1 o'clock. Thank you. We have directions. It's in the green auditorium. If you wish, you can leave your stuff here. I'll lock it up.
But they're always treated as placeholders for future actions, but after which any English will then be generated.
Good, Mike. How do you?
Oh, that's great. by the
Yeah, we're going to have to lock up here, so.
We're going to lock up. Okay. The 8th night.